When Laura and I moved down to Florida, we volunteered with the youth ministry there in that church. And each summer, we would take kids to Bryson City, North Carolina, and we would be at this camp. Youth pastor would rent out this camp, and we would have what we called summer camp. Now, my least favorite thing about summer camp was rafting down the Nantahala River. It's not because I didn't like rafting. It was because the youth pastor was committed to letting the high schoolers guide our rafts. And I did not enjoy that. We went down a number of years. I don't remember every single year. There's a few years, though, that stick out. The first one sticks out because I had no idea what to expect. I was very nervous. I didn't like letting a high schooler determine my fate, so I was very aware of that reality. Now, I was no expert in rafting, but I was pretty sure I could figure it out better than the high schooler. So I wasn't too keen on that because the high schoolers didn't have the goal that I would have. My goal would have been get down the river. Their goal was marauding, you know, pulling up alongside another raft and trying to kidnap the other kids on that raft. That was not my goal. So I really had no idea what to expect, and I knew these high schoolers were not doing what I wanted to do. And I knew that they weren't paying attention to the rafting employees that were giving these dire warnings of injury and possibly death. So, you know, I wasn't thrilled. I was nervous. There was only really one part of the rapids that were, you know, pretty significant rapids. And it really didn't matter how you approached it. They were so powerful, they basically just shot you onto the last part of the river. So nothing really was that scary ultimately on it. I didn't realize that, but it ended out just fine, maybe except for an ulcer. But other than that, I was pretty unfazed by it in the end. The second time that stuck out to me, I was conscripted by a senior that I liked, but I was pretty sure he was not going to captain this vessel very well either. Now, I started to understand a little bit about the river, so I understood where the very, very remote dangers were, roughly. It was still a little foggy. There was one particular area where I knew that the guides, the people beforehand, had given us their spiel. They told us, you want to stay left here or it's going to be a problem. I wasn't exactly sure where that was, but I had a pretty good idea. And, of course, this high schooler was busy marauding more than guiding. You know, that's what he was doing. So as we turned around the corner of that fateful bend, I knew we were going to get stuck. We were certainly going to get stuck, not for the fact that another raft had gotten stuck on Trevor's Bane. That's what we called it, Trevor's Bane, because actually that trip, we coined it because Trevor's raft got stuck on that rock. He actually got so stuck, it sunk the raft, but he kept us from getting it. We actually bumped into his raft and went around, and they had to jump into the river. It was a whole ordeal, but I remember that. So I wasn't as nervous about that time. I was just more annoyed than anything else at that trip. The last experience that I remember is also the last experience I had. And this time, the captain of our raft was my friend, the administrative pastor. And our crew were all the sixth grade girls on the trip. That's the youngest group that are allowed on this trip. And thankfully, it was a very uneventful trip. That was the goal. The goal was that these girls that were very, very nervous about this were going to have a nice trip. Everything was doing fine until the very end. The very end of this route, you know, right as you pull off, there's a little pull-off that you can check out the rapids that you're going to go down at the very end. So right after we pulled back on out into the river and really we're at the point of no return, you're going to have to hit this point, I saw the wind. Like, you know how people say you can't see the wind? I saw the wind. Like, everything moved in front of me. The water, the trees, everything was moving in front of me. And we realized, the administrative pastor and I, we realized there was something seriously wrong. Like, the weather had changed. It had been a beautiful day. Now there were these clouds overhead. So at this point, though, we knew the river well enough to understand what we needed to do. We weren't really concerned about what the river was going to do. We knew what it was going to do. It was going to shoot us out, and then at that point, we're just going to, with all our might, paddle towards the pullout. So we knew what we were supposed to do, and sure enough, that's what happened. We just got thrown down, and and into it. I don't know if we went backwards, sideways. It didn't matter. We rushed through those rapids, and then we just pointed the raft to the pullout and just paddled as quickly as we could to get out. And we got out, and we put this raft up, or we actually got under a raft, that makeshift kind of shelter, just in time to escape the hail that started to come down right then. So it was a bad day, but we made it. Now, if that had been my first experience, it would have been a much different situation. I would have been very panicked like these poor sixth grade girls who that was their first experience. I don't know if any of them ever attempted it again. But because I was informed when it came to the river, I could at least feign confidence at that point. I didn't know what was going to happen with the weather, but I knew what was going to happen with the river. So I didn't worry about that. We just worried about doing what we needed to do. It was a completely different experience than that first experience. That's how things work. You know, you have different experiences with circumstances. The circumstances may be the same, but your experience with them is different. And there is a circumstance that's true of everyone, though many, many, many people are unaware of it. They're completely uninformed when it comes to this circumstance. And it actually has the greatest impact on your life. So some people are completely uninformed. Some people are being informed about it. Others are informed. And it changes your experience. The situation doesn't change, but your experience of it changes. So this reality that I'm talking about is God's providence. So God's providence, his mysterious government of everything in the universe, that's happening whether we realize it or not. But the degree to which we understand it changes our experience of it. It changes how we experience this life that is being governed by God's providence. So just as I could go from being nervous to annoyed to really pretty comfortable with the river, based on my level of experience with it, my understanding of it, our experience of God's providence changes based on the level of understanding we have with it. If we're uninformed about God's providence, we're gonna have a certain kind of experience in life. If we're informed about it, or being informed about it, we have a different experience. So that's what we're going to see this morning. What we see in Genesis 42, where we're going to be, which is where you can turn this morning if you haven't already. We're going to see that there are three kinds of people with three kinds of experiences with God's providence. So you have people who are informed about God's providence. You have those that are being informed about God's providence. And then you have those that are uninformed about his providence. And the three experiences with that are individuals experience confirmation, conviction, and a conniption. That's what we see in this passage. So you have the informed, those being informed, the uninformed, and you have confirmation, conviction, and a conniption. So look at verses 1 through 5, where these first verses are really the setup for the passage. And they link this section of the narrative with the previous chapter. So they tell us, that previous chapter told us about the severe famine that was coming. It told us about Joseph's elevation to second in command in Egypt. The last thing we read in the previous chapter was verse 57, which says, all the earth came to Egypt to Joseph to buy grain because the famine was severe all over the earth, or over all the earth. So that's exactly where verse 1 then picks up to continue the story. It says that Jacob learned that there was grain for sale in Egypt. We're not told the significance of this until the last verse in this initial section, which says the famine was in the land of Canaan. So the famine's there in Canaan, which we could have put together from verse 57 of the last chapter. But Moses wants us to zero in. Now, here's how the last chapter, what's happened in it, is now impacting Joseph's family. So Jacob recognizes a solution to a very bad problem that he has in Canaan. But we also are made aware of another problem that's still going on in Canaan. The relationships between these family members is still not good. And you can see that in the way that Jacob responds. He sounds like Mo from the Three Stooges. When he responds to his son, why do you guys look at one another? You know, he's saying, what are you standing around looking at each other? We have a problem and there's a solution down in Egypt. You need to get there yesterday. That's his response. It's a harsh response. Now, verse 3 then gives momentous words. They tell us, we're going to see finally what we've been anticipating since chapter 37. It says, so 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. And we know what's going to happen now. So the thing that we should notice, though, in that verse is there's only 10 brothers going down. Verse 4 explicitly says there's one brother who's not going down, Benjamin. Benjamin is the one who's referred to as Joseph's brother. It's not referred to as their brother or all their brother, because Joseph is, for these 10 brothers, he's their half-brother. But Benjamin is his full brother. They both share the same mom, Rachel. And so what we see in these first few verses is that the same favoritism that we saw with Jacob showing Joseph, he's now showing that with Benjamin. Only I would say this is actually a step beyond that. Because remember, with Joseph, Jacob was willing to send him out to check out and see how his brothers were. He didn't say he had to stay with him, but that's not the case with Benjamin. Benjamin is being treated with a little bit more oversight. And he says why in verse 4. He says that he feared that harm might happen to him. He was afraid the same thing that happened to Joseph was going to happen to Benjamin. And so now he's even more tight-fisted with his favored son. He doesn't really know what happened to Joseph, but that is his fear. In verse 5, Moses does not call these sons. We should notice that he went from calling them Jacob's sons to Joseph's brothers. And then now in verse 5, he refers to them not as Joseph's brothers or as Jacob's sons. He refers to them as the sons of Israel. That's the preferred designation. As Moses writes these 5 books from Genesis to Deuteronomy, that's the preferred way he will talk about the people of Israel. It's usually translated from the King James on, or actually before that, in a gender-inclusive way as the children of Israel or the people of Israel. So it's the same terminology. Why is he using that terminology here? We're getting to the part of the story where the people that first read this book would have had their interest peaked, because one, he just named them. Two, he's explaining how things have gone about to happen, that they were in Egypt, and he's starting to explain the events that related directly to their life. And so he talks about this way so that they understand, they're starting to begin to understand the same providence that we're seeing in the life of Joseph is the very providence that was worked out in their life. So their families ended up in Egypt by that same providence. It's at this point that we start to focus on different people in the passage. And what we see is God's providence. God is bringing about the dream that he revealed to Joseph. So back in 37, we saw where this has now been headed. This is the plan. God revealed that plan early on. And so this is not coincidence, what we've been watching, what we've been seeing in these chapters. It's God's mysterious providence that he's been working out through sinners to accomplish his purposes. So the first person that we see is the one who's informed of God's providence. The first one we focus in on, I should say. By all accounts, Joseph is informed when it comes to God's providence. He understands that God has this sovereignty over what's happening. And so what that does is it brings confirmation to what he knows. When he views the world that way, he sees God's providence confirmed. And that's not just true for Joseph, it's true for us as well. And so verses 6 through 17 show us that those informed about God's providence experience confirmation. So Moses reminds us in verse 4, or in the first verse there, verse 6, what happened in chapter 41. Joseph is governor over the land, it says. And he explains what that means. He's the one who sold to all the people of the land. That's why these brothers are headed to see him. because he's the one doing the selling to everyone. Verse 6 goes on. It says, Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. That should be familiar. So Joseph saw his brothers. He recognized his brothers. But it says he treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them. That wording, treated like strangers, it's a verb that's actually the same verb translated recognized. It's just in a very different form. So there's a connection between those two things. What Joseph is doing is he's recognized them and he's making sure they don't recognize him. He's not doing anything to give up who he is to them. So it says also that, and we should just consider the fact that why would they have recognized him at this point? This is 20 years. 20 years since they'd seen him. He was 17 when they had sold him into slavery. He's now 37 at least, maybe more. So lots changed. Plus, what they're looking at is by all accounts, Egyptian. He's been thoroughly Egyptianized. He's shaven. He's got Egyptian clothing. And even if they were expecting to see their brother in Egypt, it would not be as the boss. So they have no reason to expect that this person that they're interacting with is Joseph. But why does he speak roughly to them? I think this is the part of the story where I'm not going to say do as Joseph did. At the same time, it becomes clear throughout this passage that Joseph has a plan, that this is very deliberate. He has seen his brothers, and the text in no way suggests that he's surprised. There's nothing in the text that tells us that this is a shock to him. He seems to be very calculated. We don't know if he'd been thinking about this moment. He knew it was going to happen. But he is ready for it. And so this is a very calculated response. And so Joseph interrogates them, probably like he interrogated anybody who came asking for food from other countries. He asks, where do you come from? And they tell him exactly what verse 3 told us. From the land of Canaan to buy food. Then verse 8 wants to pause and let us know Joseph has been successful here. And so it says that he recognized them, but they did not recognize him. So what does Joseph call to mind in this moment? What does he see? How does he interpret what's happening to him? Moses tells us Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed of them. The point isn't that Joseph had forgotten it and all of a sudden he sees them bowing and is like, oh yeah, that's right, I had a dream about this. The point of remembering is that he's calling this to mind. This is his way of interpreting what is happening. He's recognizing this first dream that I had has been fulfilled. Remember the first dream? The first dream was the sheaves. His brother's sheaves surrounded him, his sheaf, and they bowed to it. Now, the second dream is very specific in number. The first dream isn't. It doesn't mention numbers. It just mentions his brother's sheaves. I mean, there's a great likelihood that Benjamin at the time wasn't in the field doing these things. So it might have been 10. Nothing about that dream has not happened. Remember, what they're here to get, they're here to get grain. Where does grain come from? Sheaves. He's seeing his dream right before his own eyes, and that is what is going to determine how he reacts, how he responds. So he responds with an accusation. He says, you're spies. You've come to see the nakedness of the land. Jim Hamilton pointed out that that's a very logical accusation. Egypt, remember, is the only one who has food right now. So it would be easy to think that the enemies who are desperate, Egypt's enemies, would send spies to reconnoiter, or how do you say that word, to spy out the land before they would raid it. I mean, it makes perfect sense. Your enemies are going to try to take your stuff. And so, that's what he accuses them of. But the way that he words it, you know, when you see someone's nakedness in the Bible, it has a certain connotation, especially in certain contexts. To describe the land in that way, it sounds a lot like pillaging, is what he's describing. So he's saying, you guys came to check things out before you were going to come to raid the land, to plunder the land. And here's his brother's response in verses 10 and 11. No, my lord, your servants have come to buy food. We're all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants have never been spies. So they call Joseph their Lord. They refer to themselves as your servants. Could even possibly translate that, your slaves. They're very respectful, deferential. They explain, hey, look, we're not 10 carefully selected soldiers here on some mission. We are actually all from one family. We all have the same dad. And then they completely deny that they've ever been spies. We've never done that. They did that just before they say, we are honest men. Now, can you imagine if they realized who they were talking to? Honest men. Simeon and Levi had tricked an entire village into circumcising themselves, the men, so that they could massacre them. Honest men. And we know that Reuben had already done a very dishonest thing with his father's concubine. So, honest men. I mean, these guys had stripped Joseph himself of his robe, stuck him in an empty cistern to leave him to die, only to change their mind when they could make some money off of it and sell him into slavery. I mean, honest men, that's what they want him to believe. I mean, it is crazy to think that Joseph didn't just explode in this moment. I mean, what did it take to not explode in this moment? It took the fact that Joseph understood God's providence. He knew who was in control. It wasn't him. His dream had given him direction at this point. And we don't fully know what that plan is, but we can tell as he keeps making progress, making statements and things, that he is working towards something specific. He has a plan. So he doesn't respond with, surprise, it's me, your brother, now you're all going to die. He doesn't do that. He says, no. It is the nakedness of the land that you've come to see. Prove me wrong is basically what he's saying. Now, this is who you are. So, they plead their case in 13. We your servants, are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is no more. So now we're getting somewhere. What Joseph wants to begin to hear about. They're honest about being 12. They could have easily said they were just 11 or 10. But they did share that. They admit that their youngest is still with their father, something that Joseph may have been nervous about. I mean, he knows how they treated him. Why would he expect them not to have mistreated Benjamin? And he doesn't know that his dad is still alive. So these are all things that would have been reassuring. But last of all, they admit what they... The one detail in this little admission that they want him to focus in on the least. And so they kind of euphemistically refer to Joseph as somebody who's died. One is no more. That's all they say. So undaunted at this revelation, Joseph just continues with his plan in verses 14 through 16. Basically, he's saying there in these verses that these sons, these brothers, they're guilty until proven innocent. That's their situation. They need to prove that he's wrong about them. And he's going to hold them all in custody, except for one, and that person is supposed to go bring Benjamin to him to prove his story. And it makes sense in terms of confirmation. Okay, this is what you say, so I'm going to send one of you to go get this other brother that you're talking about. You can confirm your story that way. It's exactly what Joseph wants to happen for the rest of his plan. But he's saying that he's testing their words. But notice that the goal of that testing is to determine whether there is truth in them. You know, the word truth can be translated faithfulness. It's an aspect of a person's character. That's what he's testing at this moment. He is testing their character. Have they changed? Or are they the same group of ruthless brothers that were behind his enslavement? So to show that he's serious, verse 17 says that he put them all together in custody for 3 days. We might think that's a little harsh, but probably not for a guy who had been wrongfully imprisoned for multiple years. He knows what it's like in prison. They'll be fine for just a few days. Now, again, I'm not suggesting that we do as Joseph did, but this is still not revenge. This is a part of it. He might have enjoyed it, but this is not revenge. This is a way for him to establish that he is who he says he is, where he is in charge, and that he is serious. He is, again, he's evaluating the situation based on what he knows to be true. God has had this plan. He has revealed this. And remember, it said that he remembered his dreams. They're the dreams, plural, about them. So that second dream had definitely mentioned Benjamin being there, also mentioned his dad. So what he's doing right now is working towards that end, what God has revealed to him. He knows God is at work. He also knows that he is a part of that process. So he is active. When you know God's providence, you live accordingly. You know that God's in charge, that he has a plan for your life that he's inexplicably carrying out, then you respond to your circumstances differently than if you didn't know that. So when you're met with people who have mistreated you, you can actually not lash out at them. Why can you do that? Because we actually are privy to revelation too. We know who the Son of God is. We know the good news about him. We know that he came, and in his intentions to rescue us, he endured mistreatment. He did that to rescue us from our sin. He did that for everyone who would turn from that sin and follow him, follow in his steps. We know that's the plan. So when we're mistreated, we don't have to lash out. We can pay attention. We know that God is at work. When we remember, when we call to mind, like Joseph does, we call to mind our path. He called to mind his path by his dream. When we call to mind, when we remember our narrow path that we're on, we're following Jesus, that narrow path leads to life. That's our path. That enables us to respond the way that Joseph does here. It also confirms God's providence. When we know that God is at work in all the different things that happen, we begin to see it. We start to see that, oh, God, what God says he's going to do, he's doing, whether that's in our lives or in the treatment of others. God has told us that we're going to be mistreated by people in this world. Not just, oh, it's going to happen to everybody because it happens to everybody, but specifically because we follow Jesus, we're going to be mistreated. So when it happens, that's actually confirmation. God is sovereign. He is working out his plans. He's doing what he says. With it, Paul words it. He talks about our privilege of suffering with Christ. He says in Philippians 1:29, "For it has been granted to you that for the sake of Christ, you should not only believe in him, but also suffer for his sake." Suffering is a privilege. It's a gift that enables us to magnify our Savior by following in his steps. See, the doctrine of God's providence, it's not just pie-in-the-sky theology. It's where the rubber meets the road theology. It impacts the way that we respond in real time. When you're informed about it, you experience confirmation in your faith. Those informed about God's providence experience confirmation. The second kind of person we focus on in this passage is the one who's being informed. They're in the process of being informed about God's providence. And that's what we see with Joseph's 10 brothers. They're in process. So they experience in that process conviction of their sin. It's not just for these brothers too. What we see in verses 18 through 28 is those being informed about God's providence experience conviction. So once again, something important happens on the third day. Remember, Abraham saw Mount Moriah on the third day, and the cupbearer and baker experienced the fulfillment of their dreams on the third day. So on this third day, Joseph's plan, his proposal, is tweaked. very intentionally changed. So listen to how he begins, though. He says, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God." Ultimately, that is his goal. He wants them to live. So that he's being very honest about that, very, very clear. And he fears God. That's why he isn't killing them. That's why he isn't enslaving them. Because he fears God. And he does want them to live. That should have been a shocking thing for them to hear. This guy who's in charge here in Egypt says he fears God. You remember, Abraham lied about his wife, Sarah, saying she was his sister, because he gives this reason in Genesis 20:11. He said, "I did it because I thought there is no fear of God at all in this place." The pagans around them, the patriarchs, they don't fear God. They don't fear my God. They don't fear the God. Abraham felt that. Isaac felt that. Jacob felt that. So the fact that the guy in charge in Egypt says he fears God, that should have been a bit surprising. Because of that fear, Joseph says, "Here's how we're going to verify if you are honest men or not." And did you catch that? That is the object here. He's evaluating if they are honest men. That's the object of his investigation there in verse 19. So instead of keeping nine in custody and sending one, he's going to keep one in custody and send nine. And that enables him to allow them to carry grain for the famine of your household. That's an interesting thing to do if he supposedly thinks that they're spies. He's thinking about the household. He's thinking about their family. He knows why he's there in Egypt. So again, he acts in accordance with God's providence. But they still need to bring their youngest brother to him. And again, he ends with the point, his goal, that they not die. You remember Jacob's goal in sending them down was to live and not die. And he's said the same thing. Do this and live, that you not die. It's at this point that we get to see the brothers begin to recognize God's work in their life. Verse 21 gives an admission. It says, "Then they said to one another, 'In truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we did not listen.'" That is why this distress has come upon us. So they're convicted of their sin. We were guilty concerning our brother. But notice, it's not just that they're guilty over what they did. They give us this detail that Moses has withheld from us up to this point. He's not shared this with us. He's waited till this moment. There's something that's been growing in their recollection of that fateful day. Joseph's cries for mercy. In Edgar Allan Poe's The Telltale Heart, this man decides to murder his tenant over really just an annoyance. He's careful, he's calculated, and when he does it, and when it's all said and done, he feels like he's pulled off the perfect crime. There's just one slight hitch. The guy shrieked at one point. And that caused his neighbors to call for the police to come, and they show up at his door. But he's unfazed at that point, because again, he thinks he's pulled off the perfect crime, and so he happily invites them in. But as they stayed, he starts to get uncomfortable. And he even starts to hear something. At first, it's this ringing in his head. Then he thinks, it's not just in my head, it's outside. They can hear it. So he starts to talk louder and be a little bit more animated to try to distract them from it. And then he reaches this point. It's so loud to him that they have to be hearing it. They have to suspect something. And finally, he can't stand it anymore. "Villains," he shrieks, "dissemble no more. I admit the deed. Tear up the planks. Here. It is the beating of his heart." Of course, it's not really his heart beating. It's his guilt. But that guilt caused him to hear one of the last things that he heard. And that caused him to grow in that conviction in that way. Now, it's not the brother, it's not Joseph's heartbeat that the brothers kept hearing. They kept hearing, echoing in their heads, the cries for help from the pit. That's what they'd kept hearing. And at this point, it's obvious to them. "He begged us," they said. We didn't listen. We deserve what we're experiencing. This distress is coming because we distressed him. The distress of his soul is why we're now feeling this distress. Now, Reuben, first of all, he refers to this as a reckoning for his blood. That's legal terminology, saying they're being held accountable for this. It could be because he says it that way because he was never told the truth, or he recognizes that selling people into slavery is also worthy of death, or they all thought that maybe he was dead at this point. But Reuben isn't willing to accept the guilt. He says, "Did I not tell you not to sin against the boy, but you did not listen?" Is that really what Reuben said? Is that really how that went down? I mean, pretty sure Reuben was much slyer in that he didn't tell his brothers what he was thinking. He actually left them to think that they just leave Joseph in the cistern to die. He didn't tell them that he was going to come back and rescue him. But now he's completely innocent of the crime. Not quite, Reuben. What we learn, though, is that Joseph has been listening to this admission. He's been hearing it the whole time. They thought they were safe. They thought they could share this because of this detail we're told. There was an interpreter between them. Joseph has been maintaining his role as an Egyptian by speaking Egyptian to them and having an interpreter intercede for them. And so when he sees this, notice his response. He turned away from them and wept. He had to leave. He had to get out of there so he could express that emotion. He was overwhelmed by the fact that they had admitted their guilt. He recognized that they're beginning to respond the way that they need to, the way that they should. So he gets a hold of himself, comes back in, and he incarcerates Simeon right in front of them. He wants them to see it. It's not clear why he chose Simeon. Could be that he heard Reuben and he thought, you know what, I'm not going to take Reuben. Simeon's a second born. Could be that, well, I want Benjamin to come, who's the second born of Rachel. I'll take Leah's second born. Or it could be he realized Simeon's in the doghouse with my dad. If they've really changed, it'll be shown because this is the least person they'd come back to rescue. He's already in the outs with the family. So if they actually come back for Simeon, it would demonstrate real change. That could be. We don't know. That's who he chooses, though. It seems like he's basically in this process giving them every opportunity to fail. He does that again by giving them their money. Remember why they sold him into slavery. What good, says Judah? What good is it if we kill him? I mean, we can't make any money that way. So let's sell him. Let's get some money. So he knows they're greedy. He gives them their money. Are they going to come back for Simeon if it means they have to give up their money? Have they really changed? But Joseph does still lovingly provide for them. He provides for their return. And as they're on the way back, we get another glimpse of this growing conviction of sin. They take a pit stop. One of the brothers gets out to use some of the grain to feed the donkeys, and he realizes there's silver in his bag. His silver is still in the backpack. The way that Moses describes this, he reiterates the shock. He describes it as shock, and then he says, "My money has been put back. Here it is in the mouth of the sack." He's saying they're completely stunned by this. And then the text says their hearts failed them. More literally, that's their hearts went out, which more likely means they had no idea what to think. Their mind went blank. They had no idea what they were going to do. And they turned trembling to one another, saying, "What is this that God has done to us?" It's not happenstance. They're awakened to the fact that God is mysteriously at work in their lives. And they experience conviction. Why is that? Why would that be the case? Because when we realize that God isn't just off somewhere, not concerned about us, when we realize he is an intimate part of our lives, we realize we're sinners. You know, we can put on like we're innocent to people because we can keep our secrets hidden. But when we realize that God is such a part of this world, that he's a part of this world to this degree, we realize, well, he knows our sin. And if he's in charge and he knows exactly what I'm like, then we would be convicted of that sin. Do you realize that God is intimately acquainted with your life, that he knows everything about you, that But you cannot hide anything from God. He knows what's in your heart. You also should know that he really is in charge of the world. Do you realize that? There is a reckoning coming where we are going to give an account to this God. There's no escape from that. He is in charge of every single part of this life. Do you realize that? If you are convicted of your sin, you need to know the good news. That's why Jesus came. Because we're all in this boat. We're all in the same boat. We all have that sin in our life. None of us are perfect. We've all turned away from God. That's why Jesus came. He came to rescue us guilty sinners. He came to rescue us by taking on what he did not deserve. A punishment for sin. He came by his death to forgive sinners. To make us right with God. When he died on the cross, that wasn't a defeat. That was the plan. That this amazing God was working out to rescue sinners. So that everyone who believes that Jesus is the King, that Jesus is the King who came and died for them, that they'll experience that forgiveness, that they'll realize that their sin was expunged. The record of sin that they had was expunged on the cross when Jesus died. You need to realize that the same God who is righteous to the degree that he will punish sin on the cross by punishing his son in the place of others. That God who is righteous, he's also loving. That's why he did that. And he welcomes everyone to turn from that sin and to follow his son as King, as Savior. I would urge you to respond that way to your conviction of sin. Those informed about God's providence experience confirmation, and those being informed about God's providence, experience conviction. The third kind of person we see in this person is the uninformed person. Jacob has no excuse to be that person. He really should understand. He really should be informed, but he acts like one who has no clue about God's providence. And so his experience of God's providence involves a conniption. That's what we see. And it's not just him. We can all experience that. In verses 29 through 38, those informed about God's providence experience a conniption. So when the boys get back in town, they tell their dad what happened. They're very careful about doing that because they do want to go back and get Simeon. So they do a little finagling with the story. They rearrange some things. They tell Jacob, instead of the details that they gave and the order that they gave them, they mention Benjamin last. That's who they don't want to admit they told this guy about. So they leave him last instead of the one who is no more. They also describe Simeon's incarceration a little bit less severely, right? They just say, and he had us leave one of our brothers. It's like Simeon's just chilling back there in Egypt until they get back. Not that he's actually been put in prison. Then they also they state directly something that was only really alluded to by Joseph, that they would get Simeon back when they go. They want to make that clear, even though Joseph didn't really make that clear. And then they add something completely out of thin air. They suggest, and if we do this, then we'll get a trade in the land. Joseph never mentioned that. They're just trying to make this as good as possible for their dad. So verse 35, though, is a breaking point. Because it's at this point that they all open their sacks. They all discover the fact that they have all their money back. And they're scared. It looks like they've stolen this food now. So they're all scared, including Jacob. And he has a conniption. That's what he has. That's what he loses it in verse 36. He blames everything on them. It's their fault. You guys have bereaved me of my children. He considers Simeon a lost cause. I mean, he's as good as dead. And notice the focus on himself in those words. The Hebrew actually places the word me emphatically at the beginning of this. It's me you've taken these sons from. And then he ends with, all this has come upon or come against me. And again, the me is emphatic there. See, people don't have conniptions by thinking selflessly. He's focused on himself. And he's scared. So again, Reuben tries to set himself apart, and he suggests a plan. Kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands, and I will bring him back to you. Yeah, that's the solution, Reuben. Hey, worst case scenario, Dad, I go down there, I don't get him, and you can kill my two grandsons. How is that going to make anything better? That's a terrible plan. It's like Reuben's been taking lessons from Lot. Lot's like, take my two daughters. Reuben says, take my two sons. No, that's not the solution. It's also not selfless. So Jacob just continues his rant. He says, my son shall not go down with you. Only the you is plural. He's not pointing at Reuben. He's basically ignored Reuben. He's not going. And he refers to Joseph as Benjamin's brother, not their brother. And he says that he, Benjamin, is the only one left. Last I checked, Jacob, you had 11 sons. Even if you kick Simeon to the curb, you still got 10. He's not the only one. So he says at the end, he describes his fate. If this happens, if they were to take Benjamin and he were to lose Benjamin, he says the same thing that he said about Joseph. If harm should happen to him on the journey that you are to make, you will bring my gray hairs with sorrow to Sheol. Jacob is not in a right state of mind. And that's what being uninformed about God's providence can do. So, I mean, if you think that you really have to go it alone in this life, you should be panicked. This is a scary place. There are no assurances. If there is no God that is overseeing you, there are no assurances. It makes sense that he has a conniption here. If there is no providence, well, anxiety makes sense. It does. And understand, you don't have to literally be uninformed about this. Jacob knows about God's providence. He's experienced this, but he is acting like one who doesn't. So believers, we can act like this. Even though we know the truth, we can still act as though we're uninformed when it comes to God's providence. And that can lead to a conniption. It can lead to worry. It can lead to anxiety. Anxiety is crushing. And there are lots of reasons why it impacts different people in different ways. Some people are more prone to it, just like some people are more prone to anger. So we need to be careful. We need to address it. And the way we address it as Christians, the way it's alleviated by Christians, is by meditating on, focusing in on the fact that God is in control. God is sovereign. He is working out his plans through his mysterious providence. You don't want to be like Jacob. You're much better off to be like the one who had been sold into slavery, falsely accused and imprisoned, because his response is to see God's hand. He could rest his soul in God. We see three kinds of people in this passage. People like Jacob, who live as though they're uninformed of God's providence, and lead to a conniption. There are those like these 10 brothers, who are right now, they're being informed about God's providence, and they are convicted of their sin. And then there are those like Joseph, who are informed. And they experience confirmation of what they know. That's who you want to be. You want familiarity with God's providence. You want that to be what comes to mind, so that when the tornadic winds of life, they come at you, you don't have to panic. You know how God's providence is going to work. You know it's going to keep doing its thing. You know that God's going to work out his plan. He's going to work out his purposes, and then you can have peace like a river in your soul. Join me in prayer. Father, we thank you that you are a God who is not distant from us, that you are near to everyone who calls on you, to all who call on you in truth. Pray that those that do not know you, those that have attempted to try to order their own lives, tried to direct themselves, they'd recognize that that's not what you made them to do. They'd recognize their need to entrust themselves to you. They'd realize your goodness, your mercy in your Son. They'd realize that he is in charge. They'd realize that they are going to stand before him someday. They would want to stand before him as one who follows him, one who turns from their sin and follows him. And for us, Father, we just ask for your mercy, that we would act as those who know that you are sovereign, that know that you are in charge, that we would not act as those who think that the world is out of control. Especially in those weak moments, when there's something physical in our life that's making us weak, or whatever it may be, that we would be able to look to your providence and know that we are in your hands, and that those are the most secure hands, that you are the one who is worthy of our trust. That you would grant us the grace in that moment to do what we know we need to do, to keep following your Son on this narrow path. We know that we cannot do that in our own strength, so we ask for your Spirit to work that out in us as we take steps of faith, believing that he will. Ask it through your Son. Amen. We're going to conclude with a song that comes from Psalm 62. So if you would stand.